You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm here with Bookworm today. Our guests today are Susan Deitch, the author of The Colorist, one of the recent books from the Vintage Contemporary series, and her editor will be joining us later in the interview on the phone, Robin Desser of Vintage Books. Susan Deitch's novel, The Colorist, is her second novel. It came out this year, and her first book was called L.C. They're very unusual novels in a certain sense, in that they seem, at least to me, to be more politically and historically and, what would you say, theoretically centered than most contemporary writing is. Is this feminist writing?
Well, maybe I should start with how I came to writing. I started out as a painter, mm-hmm. and I think I was always sort of banging my head against the wall of narrative, and I was doing very sort of narrative paintings, and there were certain things that were like turning points for me in the late 70s, I guess, where I finally just stopped making art and began writing. And one of those things was I saw a videotape by Chilean artist Juan Downey at the Whitney Biennial in about 1977, and it was of a painting. It was a videotape dramatization of the painting Las Menenas by Velázquez, where he had actors performing the parts of King Philip and the Infanta and the dwarfs. And they would turn and speak and talk about what was going on in Spain at that time.
Sort of like living dioramas.
Yeah. And it was followed by a tape of a Chilean performance group called the Aleph. And following the tape, there was a statement which said all of the people you've just seen have been disappeared. And I thought, well, this is what I wanted my work to do, to be historical and political and also sometimes humorous at the same time. And it seemed to me painting couldn't do that, and narrative could encompass all those kinds of meanings. And so I think feminism at that time got into the work as well.
Both books center on a woman pseudo-artist, I guess, a would-be artist.
Well, an interpreter, someone who's in an mm-hmm. interpretive position, a position of a witness, is, I think, well, also the character of the photographer, Eamon in The Colorist, is a professional observer, mm-hmm. a sort of witness that's going to interpret whatever is going on in the story. So I think, in a way, both of these books are about watching, so it's feminism perceived or certain political situations perceived and not necessarily acted on, although sometimes they are acted on. But they're more, I think, what ties both books together, the act of interpretation, whether it's translating, done through translation, retranslation, or drawing, photography, in the case of The Colorist.
I'm talking to Susan Deitch, the author of The Colorist, a recent book from the Vintage Contemporary series. Julie Green, who's the heroine of The Colorist and who colors the frames of the comic book Electra, who's a sort of latter-day Wonder Woman. I believe that her name is only used once in the book. Now, what an odd thing. Why is that?
Julie Green's name?
Yeah.
She introduces herself as, because the book is written in the first person, I'm not the narrator, and so it's her way of talking to the audience.
It still struck me, you know, there are so many ways people can say, Julie, hi. But, you know, if you've blinked once, you might discover that you didn't know mm-hmm. the narrator's name. And it was an interesting, it makes her, as you say, as a witness, an anonymous figure mm-hmm. in the book, oddly.
There's also in a very early version of this book was published by a small press in New York called Top Stories, and in that version, which is only about 40 pages, it alternates between the first person and the third person narration, because there were things that obviously a third person narrator can know that a first person narrator can't know. And so when the book became this longer novel, I think there are some holdovers from that earlier draft with the two different points of view, and I think that might be one of them.
What are some of the, what would you call them, theoretical constructs that this book answers or responds to?
Well, in The Colorist, I think a lot of it came from my thinking about Walter Benjamin's Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, in that everything that happens in The Colorist is repeated different times through different forms of representation, whether it's photography or comics or Egyptian hieroglyphics. There was also a way in which certain theoretical work, which followed Benjamin, the Situationist Guy Debord, I think that in some of that figures into it as well.
The Situationists were the group who began to look at experience, ideally daily experience, as if it were a form of adventure, and at that, aesthetic adventure, just for the listeners who may not be aware of their texts. And some of their texts, the work began at the May 1968 student revolution, leads to a perception of the city as a kind of game board or adventure map, which is very true in this novel as well, where the comic book's heroine, Electra, is eventually imagined by the narrator to be, if she were in New York at this moment, a street person, at different times interviewed and photographed by photographers, at other times living on street corners, at still other times meeting heiresses, as in My Man Godfrey. These events are sometimes imagined out of the movies. There's reference to Hitchcock's Frenzy, to My Man Godfrey, to quite a few other movies as well. Very specific movie moments, not generalized, not you know, famous auteur moments. What's the role of movies in this book?
Well, I think they function as another kind of representation. I'm also interested in stories within stories, and they were a device for accommodating these stories within stories. And there are also times when, walking around New York, I would think of something that would remind me of that scene from My Man Godfrey, where Carol Lombard looks for a forgotten man on an ash heap, or is it the moment in Frenzy? I'd been reading the Hitchcock-Truffaut interviews, and Hitchcock talks about that kind of distancing from the spectacle, from this thing that's going on, the murder on the roof.
In that case, the camera retreating down the stairs.
Yeah, great moment.
It's incredibly frightening.
Because, I mean, that does happen. I mean, that is, I think, how a lot of crime, you know, is perceived. There's a kind of, it's distancing from it if you see something happening. I mean, not everybody runs to dial 911, I guess.
Now, I want you to be honest with me. Toward the end of this book, the character has gone from coloring comic book frames to coloring hieroglyphics and Egyptian pictures for a man who does work for a museum.
Metropolitan Museum,
Making reproduction service.
Yeah.
How does Egyptian hieroglyphs enter this book? I know Electra, Egyptian heroine, a lot of, character named Archer, a lot of mythological figures, but tell me true.
Well, it seemed to me that the story in the Egyptian hieroglyphics of Osiris and the two sisters, Isis and Nephthys, it was a kind of triangle. And this sort of triangle is going on in Julie's life as well with Amon, and that seemed a good way to repeat that. That was another form of interpretation. It's the Egyptian story is more connected to the story of Julie and Amon than Electra. But I think that the Electra tie is more graphic. It's more very simply just a graphic association that the comics would look like, in some ways, the hieroglyphics. And they're all sort of, supernatural stuff.
Julia's lover is Amon, who is a photographer, and she is often uncertain if that, her lover, that is to say, is what he is. There's a kind of feeling sometimes that perhaps they just live together or that they're collaborators. And this kind of uncertainty is mirrored in the uncertainty of, will Electra's comic strip be continued? Not what will happen next to Electra in the serial, but will anything happen next to her? Is this a modern sensibility?
I guess it could be. I mean, it seemed to me important to write about relationships in this vague sort of way, because I think things often are vague, and when they're pinned down with certain emotional signifiers, I lose interest.
Uh-huh.
I don't think vague necessarily indicates it's boring, at least I hope not, but to have the all that so pinned down, marriage, are they living together, or whatever the situation is, it seemed to close possibilities rather than open them out.
The only literary work that I noticed directly named in The Colorist, whose author Susan Deitch is sitting across from me, is Flann O'Brien, whose work I love. I wondered if you would tell listeners who may not know the work of Flann O'Brien about him a little bit and why he makes an appearance in this novel.
Well, when I had been in Ireland, a friend gave me At Swim Two Birds to read, and it's for that moment for Eamon, when he's going through the kind of photographic paralysis in this room in Belfast, is so much not a Flann O'Brien moment.
Mm-hmm.
Flann O'Brien's very funny. And
as a photographer, he's come and has been, it seems, he thinks, hired to take photographs of people meeting on a street corner on different nights and to keep them in different files. He's unaware of what these photos will be used for. Mm-hmm. He sometimes misses photographs, and at the end he decides, for fear that he will in fact not turn over the photographs to the people who may have hired him.
Yeah.
Uncertainties.
He's just not sure of the political allegiances of the people who hired him. It suddenly becomes less clear to him what he's doing in this room or why he's doing it. And it's a kind of moment of displacement, I think. And so he doesn't finish taking these photographs and he leaves.
Well, it's almost as if the characters in the book don't know what to do with their consciousness. Their consciousness, as we used to say in the 60s, has been raised, but they're living in a different time, and what to do with their heightened awareness of things becomes the issue. And in certain cases, their response seems to be not to respond or to anti-respond. It makes for a very interesting kind of writing, because the most sort of startling comic possibilities or suspense possibilities will arise and then 20 pages later be dispersed.
Yeah, although it seemed to me important to have a political subtext in this book. And in fact, it's in most of my writing, almost all of it, I think, there has to be those kinds of reference points. What the characters do with those reference points varies, but I think it was important for me to have them there. This is something they're engaged in. Eamon, as a journalist that goes into difficult situations, or a photographer that goes into difficult situations, is something that he's committed to doing, but he's not always sure what to do with the results, I think.
Flann O'Brien's work involves two, at Swim Two Birds, for instance, involves characters who are being written who eventually address the writer and come to life, take him over. And so different kinds of genre books all operate on the same plane, more or less. Cowboys, I think a big bunny rabbit, a pooka. They all gang up on poor Dermot Trellis, if I can pull the name out of thin air. God, how did I do that? I really don't know. But in this book, too, there is the feeling that Elektra in the comic book, that the people that Eamon as a news journalist is following, are all coming to life and interpenetrating in a certain way. And then, like a collage that Eamon makes, there's an incredible clarity, but then the collage is Xeroxed, re-Xeroxed, photostated from Xeroxes, and eventually you can't tell what, in fact, it's a picture of. Now, a lot of modern art, in a certain sense, ends up that way at the end of the process. What the viewer looks at is indecipherable. How does that indecipherability work here? It's a question that just occurs to me as we're sitting and talking.
Well, I think a lot of my narrative solutions maybe come from the art world, from my having one foot in that doorway. I think the Elektra, I'm not sure if this answers your question, but Electra, her function is to recontextualize Julie's life, and sort of the words and images from Julie's life end up in the rewritten version of the comic, and is Electra's literal displacement from comic space to comic earth. she reflects Julie's life, and in the process, she's taken out of the consumer circuit of comic as commodity. And she also, I think, Electra becomes more human in the course of the book.
Running throughout is a concern with the theory of color, in particular expressed in Goethe's book, The Theory of Color, but the fact that the character's name is Julie Green suggests larger concerns as well, and lack of larger concerns.
Yeah.
You know, it's a joke as well that, you know, that color can mean anything. But in a book called The Colorist, what is the function of color?
Well, I can answer that in a kind of roundabout way, in that I think often when I start out to work, to write something, I think about working. What do characters? I'm interested in working. How do they earn a living? What are their jobs? And this is also kind of tipping a hat to my life in the art world. it seemed to me that would be an interesting subject for Julie, for a source of employment, is to be a colorist. And I'm interested in what a character does, how that is connected to their life, how it informs their life. And so the idea of coloring and what color meant seemed a very rich area to me.
And also the fact that we think of colorists often in animated cartoons, and that these are stills, you know, and that all of her concerns are related to the concerns of aesthetics, but not quite. I mean, it was very interesting edge in this book between the aesthetic and the comic, you know?
Yeah. Well, also, I think my first book was so serious, very serious. And in the second book, I think more of a sense of humor came out, more comic interest did come out in it. I don't mean just literally comics, but there's more humor in it.
So, in a certain way, with the first book, which is about a woman who becomes acquainted with Delacroix, and his eventually apolitical attitudes toward art. Here in this book, which is also about a woman whose relation to art is unusual and this time somewhat comic, it seems like you're parodying certain modernist aesthetic theories. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think that, you know, all that, the theoretical interests are all in the air. What I set out to do in all of my work is to set up a kind of intertextuality, and a body of work which is easy for me to refer to is a lot of that theoretical concerns and my experience in the art world. So it's sort of a ready-made for me, and it's something that it's very difficult to get away from, in fact, in my work.
Susan Deitch, who is the author of The Colorist and who is with me today in studio at KCRW on Bookworm, is perhaps the most focused political, comical, theoretical, modernist, postmodernist writer I know of. The concerns are very particular in this book. These are not characters that you would find in any other book. The pleasure here was finding writing that you would find only in these pages. When you were writing the book, had you anxiety about its eventual publication?
Well, I think I just wanted to write the book as it seemed the best way for me to write it, and I don't think I was as anxious about it then as I might be now. It seemed to me it would be all right to write the best way I knew how. It doesn't ever seem enough to me to just write a straightforward narrative, whether it's straightforward in a chronological sense or that kind of turned in on itself story, which doesn't have other references. That's why I think that all my work goes back to this kind of intertextuality. With subsequent work, I'm more concerned with what will happen to it. How will it be received? Will it be read in the way that I thought it might be read?
And so the book came to the Vintage Contemporary series, who publish, I guess, 3 or 4 original books in paperback a year. How did it come to their attention?
My agent sent it to them, and my editor, Robin Desler, liked it and wanted to publish it. So
we're going to be talking with Robin Desler on the phone from New York now. My second guest today is Robin Desser, the editor of Susan Deitch's book, The Colorist. Sometimes we like on Bookworm to come to a knowledge of how a book arrives in our hands, and in the case of The Colorist, it's part of the Vintage Contemporary series, which are books that are published originally in paperback. They're usually ambitious books by young or new writers, sometimes not. Robin, how is it that a book comes to be a Vintage Contemporary?
Well, as you were beginning to explain, there are two types of vintage contemporaries. The first is the type that we do as originals, like Susan's book, and the second is the type that we do as reprints, books that have appeared already, sometimes within the Random House group, which is Vintage is a division of, and sometimes from another house, which we reprint in paperback. But I think the question here is why Susan's book was published as a paperback originally and how that came to be. Basically, I think that in the case of Susan's book, it's really something of a perfect paperback original. There is a great deal of play and experiment in the book. People might be more willing to experiment at a paperback price on a book that they don't know about. Susan's book is not a first novel, but her name may not be known to some people, but this is a way of getting her name out to a lot more people than you can expect to get in a hardcover edition, merely because the Vintage Contemporary series, I think, has a name for itself, and also that the price, merely that the price of the book is lower. So that we try to put books in the series in paperback that has the ability to capture the imagination of people who are willing to perhaps experiment on a name that they don't know and trust the editorial judgment of the people working at Vintage to say, this is a novel of quality. I think you'll enjoy this. Give it a shot.
Especially when the book joins the company of the books that are already in the series, books like Ann Beattie's Love Always or the Harold Brodkey book, Love and Other Sorrows, it might be a line that readers almost invariably check out. I know when I see the Vintage Contemporaries in a bookstore, I say, oh, what's new from Vintage? That came about as a recent kind of publishing decision, the books beginning to look more like one another.
Although, actually, I have to say that it isn't as recent as some people think. I mean, this series has been going on for a while, and in fact, what we've been trying to do from the standpoint of the way the books look is that at this point, the Vintage Contemporary series, like many of the other series that have cropped up in the last 4 or 5 years, have started to look too much like a series. I mean, we have established the quality of the books in the series, and now we have the ability to make the books look different from one another, and we've been trying very hard to do that. Susan's book still somewhat resembles the way the old Vintage Contemporaries looks, except that the art is what they call a full bleed art on the front of the book. However, on the books that we'll be publishing this fall, there really is a very different type of type treatment and art treatment on the cover of all these books, because what we're trying to do is say, okay, these books are published as Vintage Contemporaries, but you can't look at it and say, oh, it's one of those books. So we're trying to get the best of both worlds here in terms of the way we are marketing the books on the next lists.
As an editor, when you see a book of, when you see a short story in a literary magazine, do you solicit, do you ask and see if the young writer whose name you haven't previously heard has a book? Are these things that you actively acquire, or are they submitted to you mostly by agents?
I would say that the majority of what we publish really does come in through an agent, although I'm always on the lookout for things. I'm always trying to read small magazines and big magazines, and it's always worth, in my experience, it's always worth writing to somebody, even though sometimes as an editor you think, well, you know, there are 35 other editors writing to this person. You know, you never really know. And because I have also the ability to publish within the Random House group, that there is always a chance that you can establish a relationship with a writer early on and build that writer within the series, sometimes starting them in paperback and then moving them to a hardcover division within Random House, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or just sort of giving it a big shot with Vintage itself and seeing what happens. So I would like to say, yes, I write to a lot of people that I don't know, but there really isn't time. But I really try to do that because, actually, it's really a lot of fun to sort of initiate that kind of relationship with a writer.
I was going to say that as an editor, you're in a very happy situation there at Vintage, Robin Desser, because you are able to take on books that are somewhat less risky in paperback than they would be in hardcover. What is your background? What put you in this editorial position at Vintage?
Well, I got very lucky when I got this job. There's no question about it. I'm extremely happy in just exactly what you say, because I have, right now, I'm in a position to be publishing Larry Brown and Tomas Sanchez and Ann Beattie and Judith Freeman and Richard Ford and people like this, and then I also have the ability to do people like Susan Deitch and Steve Pett and put them out there in the world. My background is I worked at Pantheon for a little while before that. I started at St. Martin's. I majored in English. I love to read. I mean, it's really a dream job for somebody who likes to read, although friends of mine are always saying, oh, you know, you're so lucky you get to read all the time, but it really isn't true. I mean, the reading takes place at night. There really is not time during the day, pretty much, to read manuscripts. But it's the ideal thing for a person who likes people and likes nurturing somebody else's work and who likes to get involved with a text. And in terms of what I do, it has a lot to do with marketing the books, so that you really, you can go off in a lot of different directions. And I think Vintage is a good place to be doing that, because it is within a larger structure, but it's small enough so that you have the flexibility to do books of large print runs and books of smaller print runs.
Thank you, Robin, for being with us today.
Thank you, Michael.
This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.